Welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I am Michael Stein. Today, my guest is Vital Germain. He grew up in the foster care system and had many ups and downs on the streets of London. He then went to New York and had many ups and downs there until he got a job with Cirque du Soleil. Things were looking great. Then he had a massive injury and he was down again. Then he fought his way back with his first book, Flying Without a Net. He's a motivational speaker. He's an artist. He's a Renaissance man. Here is Vital Germain. Okay, I am here with Vital Germain, and you got an interesting story because it's got multi-levels because you are, like in your bio, you're an English kid, but you were born in Africa?
Correct.
You came to America by way of Canadian means of some sort? Let me start what I usually ask everybody. What was your major want when you were a kid?
Wow, you don't play. You dive straight into the deep end. What was the major want? It probably ties into the fundamental human need. I think it was the desire to be, not romantically, but the desire, the need to be loved, to be accepted, to be seen, heard, not be a statistic waiting to happen, to be somebody of value. Right. And as we get into the interview, we'll be able to understand what I mean by that. But fundamentally, to be loved.
Okay, so what did you do before you got to England?
Well, I was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which most people might remember because it's where Muhammad Ali fought George Foreman. We all remember the rumble in the jungle, Ali Bumbaye. That's where I was born. It was a Belgian colony at the time called the Belgian Congo. Then it became Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. My father is Caucasian, a Belgian, and my mother is African. Height of the Civil War. The natives were killing white people. And the white missionaries from Belgium were killing Africans. And here's me and my family stuck in the middle of this turmoil. And we managed to flee and escape to Belgium. So the first 3 years...
How old were you at that point?
6 months old. I don't remember this, but I do believe that energy, we absorb energy. We absorb intensity and things that are happening around us. So I think a part of that conflict has been absorbed in my subconscious psyche in some way, shape, or form. So we escaped to Belgium, and I live in Belgium with my mom and dad, my mom and my father, until the age of 3. Then we move to England when I'm 3. And then that's where the story only really begins and gets very, very complicated and at times very dark.
This is when you're talking about when you moved to London when you were 8 years old or how old?
No, 3 years old. So at three years old, from Brussels, Belgium, we moved to London, which I don't really remember. I have these like vague little flashes of that happening. I just remember that life being all of a sudden very different. And I don't remember having to learn English at the time. At 3, I spoke only French. And somewhere on the line, English became my mother tongue. And I've somewhat now, I still speak French, but it's not my mother tongue anymore. It's a really fascinating, confusing story that I'm really excited to share with you and your listeners. It's not your everyday.
What was your childhood like in London?
At times, great. Most childhoods full of adventure, scrape knees, you know, learning, playing, making a total fool of ourselves, making new friends. And then there's a completely different side, which was not an American story. It's not a Hollywood story. It's got an alcoholic mother, a sexually abusive father, being raised in the English foster care system, basically in a group home in an institution with kids who attempted suicide, who became teenage prostitutes. There were drug overdoses, attempted stabbings, fist fights. And so that was my environment starting at the age of 7.
What was one of the first moments that you remember that you said to yourself, okay, this is not right. This is getting scary.
It's funny because as kids, I think one of the superpowers of children is with kids are very incredibly resilient. We have a fascinating imagination. And I think for me personally, it was through the power of imagination. I just went off into these other worlds. I could simply envision this amazing world that this is what I'm going to become. Another part of the story that saved me from not going down darker paths and being able to escape sort of the clutches of dysfunction and total dysfunction and getting into drugs and things is even at a young age of 7, at 5, I had this complete awareness of what was going on around me. but I didn't view it as I'm a victim. These were the circumstances, but I realized that that's not my path. That's where I want to go, right over there. That's where I want to go. And then my imagination, I would come up with these fantasies. I was going to be one of the Jackson Five. I was going to fly one of the Jetsons, the cars in the Jetsons. I mean, I went off on these amazing tangents. I was going to score the winning goal for England in the World Cup final. And that's what kept me going, the power of imagination.
And you used to tell yourself that all this when you were a kid.
Yeah, I still do sometimes now, even though there's a bit more reality that comes into the equation. But yeah,
it's different as an adult, you know, because now we know the triad of focus. When your vocabulary and your physiology and your focus is on something, you're more apt to get there. But as a child, right, that's different. Kids are usually taught, young kids with a proper, you know, with a very enthusiastic environment, they'll be like, I want 5 swimming pools. But with what was going on with you, you know, a lot of kids probably weren't thinking what you were thinking.
No, but the power of dream and imagination is the same. Whether you are raised in a dysfunctional family or whether you are raised in a palace, you can still have aspirations. And to your point, the sure. enthusiasm that
But it wasn't prevalent where you were, the other kids probably weren't thinking this, were they? Or were a lot of them?
Well, some of the kids that I played with in the home, they all had dreams. But here are a couple of things that happened that I think kill people's dreams. One, as children, now this is a statistic and I can't remember where it's from, but apparently kids, on average, we hear 232 no's or negative comments a day. We are bombarded with, no, put that down. No, you can't do that. No, you, and that's what we're programmed with. Yes. So in some way, shape or form, the beauty of growing up in this institution, there was nobody to tell me you can't become these things. And even though my mother was an alcoholic, she was an ambitious woman when she was in her prime. And she instilled in me this belief that, Vital, you can and will become whatever you want. And those words always resonated. So as children, we, even though we're unaware, we have options. We have choices. That's what I want to do. I want to be like daddy. Or, oh no, I do not want to be like daddy.
Yeah.
Make those choices as children.
Yeah. So how did you get out of there?
Influential people in my life. So in the home, there were 1 or 2 staff members. Now, this is the real challenge of going back to my fundamental desire as a kid was to be loved. So you're growing up in this institution with staff members who don't really care about you. They come and do their shift. They're getting a paycheck. They don't care. And so you are constantly finding ways to get validation. Now, this is where the fork in the road can happen. If you want attention, you want love, and you want to be seen, you've got 2 choices. I can become a troublemaker. I can piss everybody off. I can do all the wrong things, and I'm going to get attention. Or I can be good at something, and I get praise. I enjoyed the praise more than I enjoyed the dysfunction.
What were you starting to be good at that you got praised for?
I was a pretty good soccer player or football player. So that was my strength. Like even as a 7-year-old kid, I was always the one that everybody wanted on their team. This is about, in some capacity, leadership. I wasn't the teacher's pet because I brought an apple. I was the teacher's pet because whatever needed to happen, I was all in. And that level of enthusiasm and desire and passion always sort of put me in these positions of leadership. But soccer, football, I was pretty good. I actually played for the national youth team of Belgium once upon a time.
What position?
Then I was a winger. I was a winger. But then as I got a little bit older, I then played central midfield, which would be similar to like the point guard in basketball or the quarterback in football.
Yeah, I'd love to play off. I would love you to think that I know anything about soccer. And my 2 girls play it, and I have still to this day, I know nothing about it. I'm a typical flaming American.
You need to know Ronaldo, Messi, and David Beckham. That's all you need to know.
I know Pele. That's how old I am, and that's how my soccer level goes.
By the way, praise to the American women's national team. They beat, I think, Argentina or somebody 6-0. They crushed it. The U.S. women's soccer team dominate the world. So your daughter should be very proud.
Good. I mean, they've been going, they became big like 25 years ago, right? And they're still doing
Mia
well.
Hamm. Mia Hamm. I remember.
Yeah. That was the start of it, wasn't it?
Yes, pretty much. Yeah.
All right. Not to be a downer, but I want to get to, you know, the full story. Now, you had a dark time just before you came to America, right?
You could say that. Very dark in the sense that I was in a position where it could have been very easy to lose all hope and abandon the dream.
What was going on?
I'd sacrificed everything that I knew in Belgium. I'd been working for 6 years in a nightclub. I had my friends. I had my security. But I didn't feel that Belgium could provide the dream of the person that I wanted to become. I needed broader horizons. And so I sacrificed everything that I knew to come to America, naive, romantic. I just go for it. And on several levels financially, I lived in a rat-infested studio in Manhattan while pursuing this dream, trying to become an entertainer, a performer. And you're facing rejection. You're not tall enough. You're not brown enough. You're not white enough. You're not good enough. All these reasons why you're not right for the part. And so you're struggling to make ends meet. You're literally like scraping pennies together to just get a meal. And because of my family situation, there was no safety net. I couldn't go back to mom and dad. I didn't have a home or a family to go back to. So literally it was me.
Well, when you went to America, you burned the boats.
That's exactly it. This is something that I learned years later in Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. He uses that metaphor. That's exactly what I did. And that's a part of my strategy in life. If I'm going to go for something, I don't have a plan B. I burn the lifeboats. There's no turning back. It's scary as hell. But what it makes you do is that you have no choice. You have to find a way to make it work. Now, along that way, you might fail, but knowing that you can't go back brings another element of survival, is that you then understand, if this doesn't work, I have to adapt. I don't have to abandon my dream. I have to adapt the strategy. So I'm living in a rat-infested studio. I come also to America as half black, half white, but I'm a black boy. I'm a black man. And I come to America thinking, well, they've had Martin Luther King and they've had Malcolm X and there's no racism and this is going to be awesome. And I experience racism in some levels that I just was not anticipating. I literally at one point got thrown against a police car, like five cop cars pull up. They grabbed me, threw me on the hood, twisted my arm. And I had no idea what was happening other than, Vital, don't panic, stay calm, because I'd seen TV shows. And then all of a sudden, it's all over. They just said, sorry, mistaken identity. And then that was it. And I went about my way. But that does leave scars. So you're scared. You're in this massive city that you don't know anybody. You don't know what's going on. And it can prevent you from pursuing the dream. But again, I think the lessons that I learned in childhood about resilience and staying focused, don't focus on what you don't want. Don't focus on the obstacles, focus on the solutions and the dream. And that's kind of what I did.
What was the inciting incident to get you out of that? Or was it the Cirque du Soleil segued into that?
Yeah. So after 2 years, now having said everything that I just said about staying focused, I will be completely vulnerable. Along that journey, there have been numerous times where I look in the mirror and I'm telling myself, Vital, you're a loser, you're an idiot, give up. Just give up. You weren't cut out for this. That happens, that inner voice. You suck.
Sure.
Thinking, no, yeah. Keep going. No, you. And so you go back and forth. And sometimes it's strange how the universe, Allah, God, whatever your higher power is, how that all works. Sometimes we hold on to a dream and we hold on so tight and we do everything for it and it doesn't seem to work. And there's this strange thing that can happen sometimes when you let go. And you just allow it to be what it is or what it's not. And so I've reached this point in New York where I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to have to go back home to Belgium and admit that I failed in America and I'll swallow my pride and that will be it. And then I get this opportunity to audition for this French Canadian company that I'd never heard of. People couldn't pronounce it. Even though I speak French, I couldn't pronounce it. Cirque du Soleil, what is it? Whatever that were. I go to this audition thinking, this is really, really silly. What am I doing? I'm going to be cleaning elephant dung. I'm going to roommate with a bearded lady. They're going to shoot me out of a cannon. I'm thinking of all these things. Now, the beauty in this story is that at the audition, I clown around. And what do I mean by that? I've got nothing to lose. So I am the most authentic, Vital Germain, playful, carefree, experimentational, adventurous, childlike person that I've been at any audition that I've done in the last 2 years. I didn't care. A friend of mine who had just simply mentioned, hey, V, there's this French-Canadian circus looking for ethnic dancers. So going back to sort of the racism issue or the cultural issue, most auditions were white actors, white dancers. And if you were lucky, there'd be this little insert saying, minorities encouraged to attend. Oh, thank you. Let me go and attend then. All right, great. That's how I came to hear about this audition. And so it was just one of those things. This door opened. The story gets even more interesting. They offer me the job and I say, oh, hell no. I did not sacrifice everything to run away with a silly circus from Canada. I had no idea who they were. They give me tickets to go see the show as a thank you for auditioning. I go and see the show, Saltimbanco, Battery Park, right underneath what was then the Twin Towers, literally right below that in their shadow. I go and see this show and I have like this spiritual, religious epiphany of, you know, the heavens opened and I felt the hand of Allah, the hand of God, Buddha, you name it. I was touched. And then I went home and cried that I had thrown away this opportunity. I did get the job. This is the beauty of it. They called me thinking I had said no as a leveraging point to negotiate more money. They offered me more money. And then I wasn't asking for more money. They probably thought that I was. They just made me a better offer.
So you didn't negotiate, but they gave you a better deal because they thought you were maybe lobbying for better negotiations.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, the phrase ignorance is bliss. Sometimes there is validity to that. Going back to something that you asked me earlier about the darkness of that period, during those weeks, days, months of rejection and financial worry and really not knowing what was going to happen, I sank into a depression, but at the time I didn't really realize it was a depression. I just sort of felt worthless, wasn't really that motivated, that energized anymore. And that was when I started getting into, not drugs, I've never done drugs. I started to meditate. And that's when I really began my journey into deep introspection during that time when I felt sorry for myself. I wanted to understand what was happening. How had I gotten here? What was next? The cliche answer, what am I doing? What's my purpose here? And that opened a new door for me to have to face my own demons for the first time as an adult, really look at myself.
Is meditation, do you do a lot of meditation?
Yes. Now for me, meditation can be many things. I don't go to the top of the mountain for 40 days and do this. For me, meditation can just simply be a really deep, intentional breath, inhale and exhale. I use the Insight Timer app, and what it does is it helps me, it grounds me, it gives me clarity. And when I feel, if I get any sort of moments of anxiety, it just sort of calms me down, slows down my breathing, my thoughts, my processes, and then I can kind of recalibrate and get back on track.
Yeah. No, I got the ADHD or whatever they say I do, and I picked up on some meditation, and then it's helpful along with the breathing exercises and stuff. Because I won't take anything synthetic, maybe something, sodium benzenite in my Chinese food, then maybe that's about it. But other than that, so you get the job. Now, that must have been, no pun intended, a tour de France of interesting escapades, of interesting things happening, right?
Yes. So I'd already lived a relatively multicultural life, being born in Africa, living in Belgium, raised in England. And entering Cirque du Soleil was a whole new level of understanding and being exposed to different cultures. You're working with Chinese people who don't speak a word of English. You're working with Russians who love their vodka. You're working from people from Brazil, from France, from Italy. I mean, literally, it's the United Nations, but everybody's walking on their hands instead of their feet. And they're not wearing suits, they're wearing spandex. So that was kind of the Cirque du Soleil multicultural international space station environment.
Nations of Benetton meets Barnum and Bailey.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay.
And so what happens, it starts to expand your mind because you start to see how other people process the world, how their values, their cultural values make them act differently. And you start to just simply have to embrace, well, that's how the Russians do it. And then they don't mean any malice, that's just their culture. And this is how I do it in Belgium. And this is how I do it in England. And this is how the African part of me would do it. And it completely opened my mind to a different type of leadership. And it also taught me about company culture, things in terms of professional leadership, customer experience, customer service. Really, even though I'd already played for the Belgian national youth team, I was in an environment where everybody was trying to be amazing. And that's contagious. And I quickly learned that, depending on who is around you is going to influence who you become.
Yeah. We call that sub-personalities. You know, your different personality, depending on who you're with, it's just inevitable that you have, you know, you don't lose your entire self, but there's sub-personalities that we pick up with different people.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Sub-personality, a new term for me. Thank you.
So how long did you do Cirque du Soleil for?
About 5 years and like 3 weeks or something. And then
it must have been impacting because, you know, it was 5 years and 3 weeks and a couple hours. And
well, the reason why I know that it was 5 years because I earned the distinguished 5 year Cirque du Soleil jacket, something that was
okay.
So I have the 5 year Cirque du Soleil jacket. But then the story, the Hollywood part of my story ends abruptly because I have this career ending injury and I break my leg and my ankle at the same time, rush to hospital.
How did you do that? What happened?
I wish I could say that I was trying this absolutely amazing, semi-impossible trick, but I wasn't. It was in the show called Kidam. We are in Tyson's Corner, right by Washington, D.C., and I'm in full makeup, in costume, and I'm just trying something new. But I want to add a little flavor that I've never tried before. So I'm like, yeah, you know what? Let me quickly try this. But I didn't take the precautions. I didn't have a crash mat. I didn't have somebody there to spot me, to help me out. And I just tried it. Wasn't warmed up. Wasn't really focused. And I basically did a flip with a twist. But I decided I was going to twist the other way, which is not recommended. And I land and my foot was facing backwards, but I was still facing forwards. And
was this during the show or practice?
The show had started. I was going to do this one trick and then go and do my first cue.
Yeah.
And instead, I'm lying on the floor. The tent is spinning. I'm getting this metallic taste in my mouth. I'm getting dizzy. And somebody comes over to me and says, are you okay? And I'm like, I don't think so. You might want to get the physio. I might have broken my leg. And she quickly went and got the physiotherapist. And then he called the ambulance. And then so...
Oh, man, was this in front of the whole live audience and everything?
No, luckily this was backstage, luckily, because that would have been even more.
Not that you give a shit at that point, because you're like, you know, you got the metallic taste in your mouth and you're like, your blood's flowing and, oh, God.
Yeah.
You're just worried about your limb.
Yeah. And, you know, the one lesson I learned in that moment about humility is for a split second, I arrogantly thought, I am the center of the universe. It's all about me, people. My career's come to an end. Help. And then you just sort of realize, you know what? The show's going on. I could hear the audience applauding. And you suddenly realize that life goes on.
Yeah.
For everybody, it has to go on for me too.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's wonderful. it's a hard way to learn that, but that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So after that, did you segue into your coaching, your personal growth path, or what happened after that?
Not yet. So I went through 2 years of rehab, multiple surgeries, 2 years of woe is me, violins playing, dark black angels, you know, heavy, fall into, I guess, technically my second depression. Now, earlier on, you mentioned that you never took medication. I was then introduced.
Well, I've taken it if I have to, like, you know, like if somebody's like, you're going to take it. take it or you die. And I'm like, I'll take it, but I try not to.
I can relate to that. So I go into a clinical depression and I'm prescribed Zoloft.
Yes.
And so I'm on Zoloft for a couple of years. And then I slowly wean myself off of it because I'm kind of like you. I don't want to be dependent on this plastic, generic, man-made drug. There've got to be other ways to overcome this. Meditation, really focusing on my diet, making sure that I get extra vitamin C. I got a vitamin D, get more sunshine. I started doing research. How do I combat this without being dependent on this little blue pill? So I wean myself off it, out of a depression. And for a couple of years, I'm just kind of roaming. I had already started to paint. So my only outlet...
Real quick though, did you always paint?
Very quickly, very, very quickly. While I was in Mystère, about a year into Mystère, amazing job. I was bored. I needed a challenge. I randomly took a class at UNLV. I opened the brochure and went, oh, let me take an art class. Why not? I fell in love with it, took 3 years of art at UNLV and never stopped.
Well, you're freaking amazing. We'll get into that second. Let's continue. We'll get back to that.
Thank you. So that became now my only saving grace and escape. It gave me a sense of purpose, gave me a reason to get out of bed. I would paint. And the beauty of expression, creativity, any form of expression is its therapy. It was this cathartic release of all the pent-up emotions from childhood, from being rejected in New York, from this disappointment of the Cirque du Soleil injury, from feeling hopeless. I was able to release it. And here's the beautiful part about creativity is you can say everything, but you're not really saying anything, but you're getting it out of your system. And what happens in life in relationships, our baggage, it gets pent up and then we take it out on people that we love.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
And I still do that sometimes, but through taking it out on a canvas, it allowed me to not use my friends and those that I loved as a punch bag. Sometimes.
We're only human.
That's right. That's right.
So, but you, from there though, you segued into a whole different part of your life. You wrote yes. some books, you know, and all that. How did you go from that part of your life to basically what you're doing now, right?
Yeah. So Cirque du Soleil, through their creativity and this ingenious means of expression, they inspired me to want to create something that was, you're a small pawn in this massive juggernaut of a machine. And I realized that a part of me kind of naively thought, I can do this, I can create, because I had all this imagination. And then I also had my story. And I remember reaching out to one of the performers at Mystère who was writing a book. And I asked him if he would write my book, my story. And he said, no. And I thought, what an asshole. Then you know what? Then I'm going to have to do it myself. Mm-hmm. So I just went back to UNLV, started taking English classes, and they told me that I couldn't write. So I had to go back and do not even English 101. What comes before English A and English B?
Okay.
I literally went back to the basics for a couple of years at Community College of Southern Nevada, learned how to write, and then I just started writing. And that slowly turned into a book. I shared it with friends and they're like, oh my God, Vital, this is amazing. This is so powerful, so inspiring. Make it a book. How do you make it a book? And I signed up for a writer's group called the Henderson Writers Group. So if there are any wannabe authors out there, join a writer's group. They will guide you. They will help you, offer you support. And then so all these emotions and stories and memories, I formed them into a book called Flying Without a Net, which is partially about life in Cirque du Soleil and partially about the journey of overcoming the abuse, adversity, being resilient. And so that became a best-selling book. And then I realized there's more in me. So then I wrote a second book, a third book, a fourth book, a fifth book, and a sixth book. I wrote six books.
Writing books are brutal. I mean, I've been trying to write one book for like years, but it's a siege of like, you know, discipline and your extra time and concentration and organization. You know, for someone like me with an ADHD, you know, somebody, you know, it's a brutal task. Did you find it brutal?
It is a brutal task, but fortunately, I think as a child, the dream of becoming a soccer player, I was disciplined. Being in Cirque du Soleil, I was surrounded by people who were much more disciplined than me, who helped me step up my game. So they were all the influences that really made me decide, okay, well, if you're going to do something, you've got to commit to it. You can't just do it on a Monday when you feel like it. No, you've got to do the work and sit down and focus. And it also ties back into the very beginning of the conversation. I want to be loved. I want to be accepted. I want to be validated. As a child, I learned, well, if you create and you do well at things, people admire you. The applause in the theater, that's kind of a form of love. It's not, but we translate it as that. And so I wrote these books and people are like, oh my God, Vital, you're amazing. This is a great book. It's endorphins. You feel good about yourself. And that's the only thing that I'm addicted to. I'm going to be completely honest and open. The applause is my drug.
Yes, I get it. I get it.
And that's what really drives me.
Yeah. I was a comedian for since I was 19. It's you're whoring yourself out for the next laugh. And if one person laughs, you just, oh, now I just can't keep going. So you write these books, and then what happened out? Did you get your motivational speaking gigs after you wrote the books? And people said, you know, you got to come speak here. How did that start? Because you talked in front of big crowds, and this is what you do now, right?
Yes, I've been lucky to talk in front of large crowds for Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies, but I wish I could say the journey into that world was a master plan. It wasn't. I was at the writers group and somebody said, hey, I'm a member of Toastmasters. You should come check it out. Toastmasters? Sounds like a silly name. Let me go check it out. Yeah. I went to Toastmasters, fell in love with it, and went religiously for the next 2 years. So I've had acting experience. So I enjoyed speaking on stage, but speaking other people's words. And then I realized, like, I can now use my story. I've written this book. I can use my story to help people. And that's kind of how the transformation or life guided me down this path. And then the rest is simply, you know, you do a small gig where you do it for free. Then you get a gig where somebody pays you $100. Yeah, I got paid $100 to speak. And then progressively you... Like every journey in life, you start to understand how to package what it is that the value creation that you have. You package it, you promote it, you sell it, you market it. And you continually, going back to the Cirque du Soleil thing, what I learned about them is that they are in constant flux, continually evolving, learning, growing, making mistakes. But there's always this innovation mindset that goes on. And that's kind of how I did it as a speaker.
Yes. Yes. So, let's talk about your art real quick. So do you sell it at galleries or what's good? Because you have a lot of artwork.
Yes. So for a while, I was what some people might consider an established artist. I was very blessed and had exhibits at the Jacob Javits Center. I was in some upscale galleries around the US and everything went well. And then 9/11 happened. Several of the galleries that I was in shut down. They basically shipped back a lot of my artwork. And without getting into the depth of the emotional impact, but that rejection with my background is devastating in any way, shape, or form. That's one of my big demons, my Achilles heel rejection. It kills me, it crushes me. And so this truck arrives in front of my door and just dumps all my artwork and thank you very much, but we don't want it anymore. And that really hurt. And I literally shut off emotionally, professionally, the taste in my mouth from that feeling. I stopped painting for about 8 years, which was good because I focused on the speaking. So it's hard to juggle two careers. Right. So I gave up one while working on the other. And life is strange. I've come full circle. I started painting again about 4 or 5 months ago, and it feels so good.
Yeah, I love your artwork. It's great. It's on your website, you have artwork. Is that from the 9/11 era or is that more recent?
No, what I'm posting now is more recent and I have been prolific. I mean, I paint every day in some capacity and I dive full in and it's my therapy.
So the colors on your website are very bright and positive and uplifting. Is your artwork in the 9/11 era the same or would you say it's darker?
I'm going to say it was probably a little bit darker. Okay. I mean, I do like... When I say drama, not to stir the pot, but drama because that's a reflection of life. We all go through challenges and trials. And if I use the storm as the metaphor, you're in the thick of the storm and the sails are shredding, but there's always hope. So what the drama represents for me has always been the element of hope. One of my favorite words, I actually got a tattoo for my 50th birthday that says hope. The element of hope is also one of my North Stars that has helped me navigate some of my darker moments. But there's still an element of drama in my current paintings. But for whatever reason, is it the reflection of my mindset? Is a reflection of, I don't know, I mean, we're going through COVID-19 right now. That's not exactly a moment of celebration. For whatever reason, my colors, to your point, are more vibrant. They are brighter. I'm letting it happen. I'm not overanalyzing it. That's another thing I've learned with maturity is think less, just be, and just do.
Right. Well, what's on the horizon for you? What do you got next? What's going on? What are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm going to focus on building my art career again. But this time, the world has changed since 9/11. We are empowered through the internet. There's no longer the middleman. We're seeing that happen in the record industry, the music industry. So now it's a question of going back to the innovation mindset and adapting. I now have to adapt. Galleries aren't open right now, so I've got to learn new skills. Online marketing, how do I promote my artwork without being in person? So I'm an eternal student, but now I'm really back at school trying to figure out this next chapter. But my ambition and my hope is still there. So that's, and my imagination. So what happens tomorrow is a mystery, and I will embrace it, whatever it is.
Vital Germain, you are a walking piece of artwork, man. I tell you, you have tons of like subparts to you and just all kinds of avenues. I really enjoyed talking to you tonight. You're a stone cold, cool dude. And I'm glad I got to meet you. And I love your story a lot. And thanks for sharing it today.
It's a pleasure, Michael. And by the way, like I said earlier, I checked you out. Your story unto itself is ridiculous. It's inspiring. I love what you're doing, by the way. And that's why when we were introduced, I was like, yes, I want to be on this guy's podcast, because what you're bringing a lot of value to a lot of people. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you so much. Well, my friend, I know we're going to see each other again. Thank you so much for doing the show today.
Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was Vital Germain. Super nice guy. Very inspiring. What's great about Vital is he's been there, he's done that, and he's just genuine. He's a genuine person who doesn't need to have pretense anymore. He's been through the gauntlet, and now he's just succeeding. Thank you for joining us. Look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right. If you want to find out more about our show, go to longshotleaders.com. If you want to be a part of something special and get your daily dose of inspiration, perspiration, exasperation, knowledge, and creativity, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we do, share our show with your family and your friends, and put some positivity out there in the world. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again on the next episode, I bid you adieu. Where did I get French from?